Hi, my name is Sam Williams, and welcome to part 2 of episode number 205 of my 60 Music Podcast, The Millennial Throwback Machine. So first of all, I'd like to welcome all you to part 2 of episode number 205 of my 60 Music Podcast, The Millennial Throwback Machine. I'm Sam Williams, and for those of you who are just now discovering this podcast, either on the Apple Podcast app, or in Stitcher, or in iHeartRadio, Google Play Music, or on Spotify, and you're wondering, so what the heck is Zums to give you a description what this show is all about? Okay, so I'm Sam Williams, and I'm a 27-year-old songwriter slash producer, but I'm also a 60 Music fan slash expert slash star. And each week with this podcast, I take one song by one artist and 60 some of the show in two parts. First part of the show, I talk about my opinion of the song and why I think it's so good or why I think it sucks, into my own personal analysis on the original song, which will include the chorus, melody, and lyrics. And the second part of the show, deep into the history behind that track. And that part of the show, talk about who wrote the song, who produced it, we'll see the song is recorded at, talk about the session players that played on the song, the songwriters that wrote the song, the producer that produced it, and the peeps this song made up originally in Billboard Hot 100 charts first came out, and the year when the song was released. All that is in the second part of the show. Now, before we move on this week's episode of the podcast, I'm sure most of you guys know this by now, but my new song, I Don't Look the Same Anymore, is finally out as of a couple weeks ago. And here's the thing. So, if you really want to hear the song at its best, I'm mainly posting on TikTok these days. So if you really want to hear, you know, to get the whole picture of the song, what it's really all about, then follow me on there. It's the same as my Instagram handle, iHeartOldies. That's mainly why I'm posting these days is TikTok. But the other thing is that one thing that I've just decided recently is that I'm just done with trying to push my music to people on social media, because it is very frustrating, because it is one of the most difficult things you can do as an independent artist on social media, is to drive your followers from whatever account that you have from your social media account and get them to listen to your music on Spotify. That is one of the hardest things you can do as an independent artist. It's so difficult to like get those people off of TikTok and Instagram to get them to click on your Spotify and listen to your music. It is so hard to do that. And, you know, that's when I decided, you know what, I really don't want to just try to push my music to people on social media, because it's really hard to get people to, like, you know, actually listen to your music, and two, through social media, and two, it's like you're fighting against an algorithm of, like, you know, the social media platforms, the algorithm is forcing you to not reach as many people as you like to. Or it's hand selecting the people that, you know, pay attention and your stuff the most and shoving your posts to those people. But then other people who are following you aren't getting to see your posts at all, because they're not scrolling through TikTok as much as you like them to, and they're not really watching and paying attention to your posts as much as you like them to. So with that being said, I decided that I really don't want to try to focus so much on trying to push my music to people on social media, but instead, I'm looking into more indirect ways people can listen to my music. And one of the most greatest indirect ways to really build a fan base, and this is aside from just sync placements, getting your songs placed in movies, TV shows, and commercials, because that's amazing too, because then you get like so much money from your song getting used in a movie, TV show, or commercial, and lots of people are hearing it because everyone who's watching the show gets to hear your song. But this is another great way too to really get your music in front of people indirectly, meaning they're not necessarily going out and looking for your song. They're essentially hearing your song by circumstance. Like, do they just happen upon it? And what I'm talking about is getting your music placed in playlists for different music stores. Well, actually, more how should I say this? It's music stores too, but actually just businesses in general, like getting your songs onto the playlist for different businesses. Like if you've ever walked inside of a Starbucks, or if you ever walked inside of a mall, or if you ever walked inside of a, I don't know, a Home Depot, or like wherever really. I mean, there's so many businesses out there that use music for their playlists. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, it's just one of those things where it's like, and the thing is that if they accept your music and they decide to play your music in the stores, that's lots and lots of people out there who are essentially hearing your music for the first time, and they may have never heard your music before ever. They have no idea who you are. And then if they like your music, and if it's good music, in which it should be, and that's the case with me, at least, if it's good music, then they'll Shazam you, and then they'll want to stream you on Spotify or Apple Music. And the next thing you know, you're getting more streams, and the streams are coming from actual real people. They're not botted streams, you know, from playlists that are botted. None of that. It's actual streams from real people who listen to your music in real life, you know, from going to like a Starbucks or wherever, you know, and they hear your music and play through the stores. And then next thing you know, they're hearing your, you know, they're streaming your music, and it's real streams coming from real people. And that's the beauty of it. And I'm really striving for that to happen from my music. But there has been a little bit of a hold up with my school's music library in terms of them pitching my music specifically, because it's more of a bureaucratic thing happening, you know, where they're trying to figure out like what's the next best move in terms of how much they want to get involved in placing my music, you know. So there has been kind of a hold up with that, but I'm hoping that gets resolved soon, because I'm, you know, as of right now, I'm in a very tough financial position right now. I get my monthly income is just, I get paid once a month and that's it. So that's really hard. And, you know, I have a paid internship, but that, you know, sometimes I get paid for that, sometimes I don't. So it should be more consistent, but there's just been, you know, it's a little, you know, it's just, you know, sometimes things happen and then I don't get paid. So, you know, it's, yeah, I mean, I would love for that progress to be made. And, I mean, you guys can support me and sign up for the premium subscription version of this podcast. Cause I got another interview coming out this month with Tony Powers, songwriter who wrote with Ellie Greenwich and, Helen Miller and George Fishkoff. He wrote 90.6 by Keith, Same at the One I'm Gonna Marry by Darling Love, and, some other songs to like Remember Then by the Earls. He wrote with Beverly Ross. So, I mean, it's a pretty good interview. There's some good stuff in there. You know, so I'd love to, if you guys can sign up for the premium subscription versions podcast. And like, if I could always say, it's like a time machine. You're getting to hear the stories about the musicians who made that music back in the 60s. It's really cool. Hope you guys will sign up for that. But also, hope you listen to my song, Don't Look the Same Anymore. I mean, I'm hoping it kind of motivates you to just keep up with your fitness and just really, you know, hope it motivates you to make a change in your physical health and your diet and your exercise. And, you know, I hope that it kind of pivots you into really getting fit, if that's what you need to do. I mean, if you feel like you need to lose weight, then this song will be motivate you to doing that. Because I did, and because I did that, I wrote a song about it. So, but yeah, I mean, keep listening to that song, and just know that the next single's coming. I actually already put it in the distribution pipeline already. It's coming out next month in March on the 15th. But for now, just keep streaming this one. And then basically, once we kind of get to the end of February, I'll talk more about the next song coming out. But for now, just keep enjoying Don't Look the Same Anymore. And let's get started in this week's show. Okay, so here's the thing. So this song, What Does It Take to Win Your Love for Me, it was released on Motown Records, you know, one of their subsidiary labels. And I know that I've talked about the history of Motown before. I mean, I did a song by the Originals, Baby, I'm For Real, a while back. I think during the pandemic, I did a song talking about the history behind that song. And so I've talked about Berry Gordy before. And so I'm not going to go into too much detail about the history behind the record company, but just in case, if you're like a total noob about sort of the history of Motown, you don't really know too much about it. I mean, just a quick little brief sort of summarization about the history of Motown. So Berry Gordy, started the record company, and he was originally a songwriter for Jackie Wilson. He was a boxer training for Jackie Wilson. Jackie Wilson wanted to be a fighter, and then he changed his mind and wanted to be a singer. Jackie Wilson got signed to Brunswick Records, and basically Berry Gordy wrote a bunch of hits for Jackie Wilson with Gwen Fuqua and a couple other people, and Gwen DiCarlo and all those people. And he wrote a bunch of hits for Jackie Wilson. And because of all the, and from all the money that he earned from basically writing all those hits for Jackie Wilson, he started his own record company, and he wanted to own his own masters, so that way he can make the most money instead of just being a songwriter, only getting part of the money from performance royalties. He wanted to own the masters too, so he decided to form a record company, took out a loan from his family, and borrowed money from his family to set up the garage at West Grand Boulevard in Detroit. He basically set up his own makeshift recording studio in Detroit, and basically he took out a loan from his family to do that. And you know, he is one of the first records he made with Barrett Strong, which just passed away, Money That's What I Want. And by the way, here's something you probably didn't know about that song. Barrett Strong allegedly said he co-wrote that song with Berry Gordy and Jamie Bradford, but Berry Gordy and Jamie Bradford are the only ones that got credit, and Barrett Strong did not get credit. So that's something you probably don't even know, that, and that he probably co-wrote the song, but Berry Gordy just didn't include him as a co-writer in the song. But yeah, I mean, that was one of his first releases, and it just became a huge hit for a label, and then he was able to pay back the loan that he initiated from his family, and basically. He was able to, you know, be successful because he had a hit song. And but one thing that I wanted to say actually about Motown, I think I might have mentioned this before. Motown wasn't, in the beginning, wasn't as big, as powerful as it would wind up being. So he started a couple different labels. One of them was named after his sister Anna Gordy, and then basically. He started another label called Tamlin Records, which was a tribute to a movie character named Tammy, who was a teenage girl, white teenage girl, and there was a bunch of movies made about her. And basically he started the Tamlin label, and basically that was named after her. And in the beginning there really wasn't a Motown label. There was just a bunch of different labels. There's the Anna label, then there's the Tamla label, and it was named after Tammy, the character in those movies, those teenage girl in those movies. And the thing is that the Motown in the beginning, since they didn't have as many hits yet, the distribution wasn't as strong for them to, you know, if they did have a hit song, they didn't have enough money coming in from record sales to be able to have strong enough distribution. So a couple artists that were originally on the Motown label got, you know, in the first sort of wave of Motown artists, at least in the beginning, the very beginning, they wound up being signed to other labels, or Berry Gordy made deals with other labels, so that way the artists could get stronger distribution, they can have bigger hits all across the country. And one of those artists is Marv Johnson, because Marv Johnson was one of the first artists, the first Motown release, Come to Me, Marv Johnson. He later actually wound up getting signed to United Artists. Berry Gordy basically made deal with United Artists Records and had him as an artist on the label. And even though those were all Motown sessions recorded in Detroit, they were released on United Artists because Berry Gordy didn't have the strong enough distribution yet because he wasn't getting enough record sales yet to have stronger distribution to get more records out there to more record stores and DJs. So, but United Artists was a very established record company at that point, and he teamed up with them so that way Marv Johnson gets stronger distribution and have more success as an artist at that point. And yeah, I mean, also, and that's another interesting thing. So Marv Johnson, one of his most recognizable hits was a song called "You Got What It Takes." Now here's the thing. So that song, even though the writing credits are Berry Gordy and his team of writers at the time, Gwen Fuqua, Tyrone Carl, all those people, even though it was Berry and his team of writers, Allegedly, and this is another thing that, so this is sort of started to become like I'm saying Barry Gordy was a shyster, and he kind of was, to be honest with you. I mean, I hate saying this because I don't want to offend anybody who loves Motown, but there was some underhanded stuff going on with their record company, and Barry Gordy was no saint. There were other people and other record company heads that were doing very shiesty stuff. I mean, Morris Levy is a great example. I mean, Morris Levy literally put his name down as a writer on a lot of different stuff. He had nothing to do with writing, and he just wanted to get that performance or those performance royalties from ASCAP or BMI, so that way he could make more money along with owning the masters, with starting his record company, Roulette Records. So what I'm trying to say is that even though the song writing credits go to Barry Gordy's team, if you got what it takes, Bobby Parker allegedly wrote the song first and recorded it first. It was, in fact, he did the first recording of it. And originally, when that single came out, it was just the writing credits were just him, and that's it. But then when the song came out again by Marv Johnson, when Marv Johnson covered it, his name was totally left off the label as a writer, and then it was all Barry Gordy's people. And essentially, Barry Gordy stole his song from him, and Bobby Parker was like, "I, there's no way I can fight against that because Barry Gordy's too huge. He's the owner of Motown now, this huge successful label." So, and that did happen a lot, and that's just something to keep in mind about the music business in general, because I hate to say it, but you know, you may love this music. You may love listening to it. And I love listening to it too. I mean, I do. But it's you have to keep in mind that if you look at rock and roll history and look at what happened within the music business, the music may have been great, but what happened behind the scenes in the music business was a lot of times really, really shitty. I mean, there were so many things that happened with, you know, the fact that, you know, even just for example, like the fact that, you know, the musicians unions didn't keep a lot of their contracts, and therefore the session players only got paid their session fees for the songs they played on back then, and that's it. And then years and years later, when these songs got used in movies and TV shows and commercials, they didn't earn anything because no one kept any records of who played on what. I mean, that's another shitty thing that happened in the music business. But also the fact that people wrote songs, but then people's names were added on as writers, and they had nothing to do with writing the song. And, you know, people's names are taken off of writing credits. I mean, it just that this is just sort of a thing that happened with the music business back then. And it's something a lot of people don't recognize specifically, because, I mean, for every average fan out there who listens to music, goes to concerts, they're not really aware of what happens within the music industry itself. All they know is that, damn, this is a great song. I love it. I'm listening to it. It's awesome. I'm going to this concert. I'm enjoying every minute of it. I love singing. I'm singing along all the songs. They don't really know what's going on behind the scenes. They don't really understand the mechanics that go into the music business like I do, because I went to school for it, and I went to Musicians Institute, and I know what happens behind the scenes of the music business. And I know that it's not always pretty. I mean, there's a lot of horror stories that happen in the music business, and it's just one of those things where it's like that's just how it was back then. I mean, it wasn't as great as you think it was. I mean, not every songwriter wound up being rich and having and you know wound up supporting themselves. I mean, there are a lot of songwriters that just it just got ugly back then. And if you listen to more of my premium interview episodes, you'll hear a lot of that, you know, coming from these guys. You'll hear a lot of just the not so great part of the music business that happened back in the 60s. But giving credit where credit is due, Barry Gordy did start the Motown Record Company, and he started all those subsidiary labels too, like Gordy and Soul and VIP. And you know why he did that? I've talked about this before. Radio stations wouldn't play songs that wouldn't play a bunch of songs by the same record company. So record company started a bunch of subsidiary labels, and it was controlled by them. But they wanted to start a bunch of other labels and a bunch of different names, so that way the stations could play more of their songs, and that way they can get more radio airplay. You know, so that's something that Barry Gordy did, just like everybody else. You know, so I think the big difference between Motown and a lot of the other labels and other, all across the country, and I've analyzed the, you know, Chicago soul. I've analyzed Nashville. I've analyzed Memphis. I've analyzed New York. I've analyzed Los Angeles. I've analyzed Philadelphia and all these different cities all across the country. And, you know, I honestly think the biggest difference between all those other places and Detroit, Michigan and Hittsville, USA and West Grand Boulevard and Motown. And this is the thing that set Motown apart from all the other places is that I think I've talked about this before. You know, the music business in Detroit was owned by Berry Gordy in the 60s. Nobody can touch Berry Gordy in Detroit back then. Nobody. And, you know, it was one of those things where it's like Berry Gordy owned the music business in Detroit back in the 60s. Motown was by far the most successful record company, and not just in the world, but in literally the whole city of Detroit. I mean, they were kind of like the Apple of, you know, the music business back then. I mean, in Detroit specifically. I mean, they monopolized the entire music industry in Detroit, just like kind of what's happening now with Ticketmaster trying to monopolize the whole live music touring business and the whole live music industry, like, you know, with concerts and everything. That very same thing happened with Motown back in the 60s. I mean, they monopolized the entire music business in Detroit. And, of course, they did because the Supremes were one of the biggest, most successful artists of the 60s next to the Beatles. I mean, it was the Beatles, the Supremes, the Beach Boys, and the Four Seasons. And it didn't get, you know, those groups had a million hits. And the Supremes had just as many number one hits as the Beatles, and probably even more, you know, and they were on the Motown record company. So, I mean, you know, it was just, and, you know, and but Berry Gordy was smart too. I mean, he was a shyster, but he was smart because he knew how to operate a record company, and he knew how to operate one, but also how to manage one, so that way all the artists can get all the attention that they need from all the people that are involved in the Motown Record Company, from the choreographers, the marketing people, to the dance, you know, the dance people, to the hairstylists, and, you know, the fashion designers. I mean Motown was a whole operation, because everyone was working for Motown. Everyone was basically an employee for Motown. I mean, you know, that's the other thing. So, you know, Motown, everybody that was signed to Motown Records or involved with Motown Records, they worked exclusively for them, really, for the most part. I mean, you know, the musicians were mostly, I mean, every Motown record featured the same exact musicians, and they didn't really play on too many other records other than the Motown sessions. I mean, they did Moonlights on some other sessions because, you know, Berry Gordy wasn't paying them enough and they needed to do more sessions. But for the most part, I mean, everyone that was involved with the company with Motown, they stuck with them. They didn't go with anybody else, really. You know, I mean, the songwriters that were on Motown only wrote for Motown. There was also a thing where a lot of artists at the time, a lot of Motown artists, they may have been able to record other songs that had nothing to do with Motown for album cuts, but a lot of artists that were not signed to Motown and were out of L.A. or New York, they couldn't really record Motown songs, and Motown writers couldn't write for anybody else except for Motown artists. Holland Dozier Holland couldn't write for anybody else except for the Supremes and the Four Tops. I mean, they were locked into writing to those artists. And Smokey Robinson was the same thing. He had no choice but to write for Marvin Gaye and the Marvelettes and other artists. I mean, Norm Whitfield is the same thing. He can only write for the Temptations and Gladys Knight and the Pips. And, you know, I mean, basically, like, everybody, none of the writers could really write for anybody else outside of Motown. I mean, they were locked in, really. And that was the big, and so here's the thing. That was Motown, right? But then if you look at L.A. and New York, for instance, where, you know, you had different writers signing different publishing companies, I mean, the Brill Building writers wrote songs for everybody, for tons of other record companies. Other artists signed other labels. I mean, the Brill Building writers wrote for a bunch of different artists signed to a bunch of different record companies, both from ranging from the independent record companies like, you know, like Roulette or you know, Dimension, or you know, even from the small independent record companies that, you know, that nobody really remembers, but I mean, like Colplex, and then also to the big, huge, like big corporate record companies like Columbia and RCA and Capitol, and like, you know, it's like the big corporate record companies. I mean, the Brill Building writers wrote for other bunch of different artists for a bunch of different record companies. But the Motown writers, all the songs that they wrote were for the Motown artists. They couldn't write for anybody else, for the most part. And just, but the Brill Building writers could write for a bunch of different artists, for a bunch of different record companies, because they weren't bound to only writing, because they were just, the fact of the matter is that those Brill Building writers, they weren't on contract with the record company. They were contract with publishing companies, so they could write for anybody, really. And those session musicians that played on those records, I mean, they played for tons of artists for tons of different record companies. I mean, you know, from independent companies like Lori and, you know, Kama Sutra and, you know, Roulette and all these different independent record companies based in New York. I mean, those session musicians played on tons and tons of records for a bunch of different, you know, artists, signed to a bunch of different labels, whereas Motown, for the most part, everything was in-house. I mean, the session players played on Motown records, the Motown people just, they stuck with them, and, you know, I think that really was something that paid off for them, because, I mean, they, you know, Motown really wanted exclusivity on their writers, and it's just one of those things where it's like, that was sort of the thing with that record company, and, I think it really paid off for them, to be honest with you, because, you know, Motown had a ton of success, and a lot of their success had to do with the fact that they would meet up every Friday morning and then listen to records and then figure out what songs are going to get released every week. And they would kind of vote as to what songs would come out and which ones wouldn't. And they owe a lot of their success to those Friday morning meetings that they would have. To see like what songs would get released and which ones wouldn't. Other record companies at the time, they just literally released anything that was being recorded in hopes that maybe a song would be a hit. But a lot of times there was no discussion being made before the song came out as to whether or not the song would be a hit. They would just record it, you know, put it out, and then hope to, you know, literally just throw the dice onto the table in the showroom and hope that it's going to be a hit. Like, that's basically what they did. They rolled the dice and hope that maybe one of their songs that they put out would be a hit. But Motown didn't do that. They actually talked about, okay, this song is being recorded this week by the Supremes, and it's a Holland Dozier Holland song, and we're going to listen to it and see if it's going to be a hit. The Stevie Wonder song that just came up, that was co-written by Sylvia Moy and Hank Cosby, and, you know, it was produced by Clarence Paul. Let's listen to it and see if it's going to be a hit, you know. And then they would just, like, and then you have, like, people like Mickey Stevenson, who was the A&R guy for the record company, who actually discovered the Funk Brothers and brought them into the record company, by the way. He was the one who found them and brought them into the studio and, you know, and actually nurtured them and actually, basically he was the one responsible for bringing the Motown band to Berry Gordy, the studio house band, the Funk Brothers. But yeah, they would listen to these songs every week and just decide what was going to get released and what wasn't. And most of the time they were right, because the songs that did come out were basically hits. I mean, Motown didn't have a whole lot of misses. I mean, every single song they put out was a hit. I mean, really, that's just that they had that good of a track record. Other record companies didn't have that good of a track record. I mean, there were a lot of small independent record companies back in the 60s, like Paula and Abnak, and really just obscure record companies that maybe had one or two big hits, but that's it. Like, they had a bunch of misses, like Double Shot Records. I mean, all those record companies, they had like one or two big hits, but then a bunch of flops, songs that didn't make it. Motown was not one of those record companies. They basically, like, their track record for hits was amazing. I mean, their batting average for having hit songs was incredible. I mean, they always had hits, no matter what. I mean, it's amazing the success the record company had at that time. And, you know, and they've stood the test of time, because to this day, the people involved with the record company still get honored, they still get a lot of recognition, notoriety. I mean, you know, Hal Wynn and Joseph Hooven, who discovered Double Shot Records, the record I just mentioned, no one talks about them anymore. I mean, you know, it's like but Berry Gordy and Smokey Robinson, who were there from the Motown right around the very beginning, with Shop Around from 1960, which was one of Motown's first big hits in the pop charts. After Money, That's What I Want, and Berry Gordy, who produced the record. I mean, they're literally getting awarded like a lifetime. I forget what it is, but some kind of it's an award for making sure music is being educated in schools. They're literally going to get awarded for that, by the Grammy Foundation. You know, they're literally, you know, that, and that's happening, like, I think this week is Grammy week, so, or it already happened, I'm not exactly sure, but but literally it's 2023, 63 years later, actually 64 years later, after the Motown company got started, and yet, you know, the people who were involved with the record company from day one are still getting honored to this day. And it's funny, because there were so many labels back then, back in the 60s, that are just forgotten about, that no one really remembers at all. Like the label I was just talking about, Double Shot Records. I mean, there were so many labels back then. Like for example, Big Top Records. Who remembers Big Top Records? Nobody. Harry Balk's record company in New York City. Like the record company Del Shannon was on, and Donnie Juan and all those artists. Sammy Turner. Nobody remembers Double Shot, but everybody remembers Motown. I mean, sorry. Nobody remembers Big Top Records. It was an independent record company out of New York City. Nobody remembers that record company, or Old Town Records, you know, the company out of New York City, the one based in the Brill Building, Chaim Weiss's record company, that the Fiesta is so fine, the Earls remember then. Nobody remembers those record companies or talks about them today, but everybody still remembers Motown, and they still get recognized and talked about in today's world. And there is something to be said about that, for a record company to have legs to be able to last this long and continue to still be relevant, still get notoriety and recognition to this day, 64 years after the record company got started in 1959. So it is just, it's insane. It really is. I mean, that they still get recognized to this day. And now I'm going to talk a little bit about the history behind Junior Rock and the All-Stars. Okay, so before I get into Junior Rocker's history, I wanted to just want you to understand this concept that you may not get if all you listen to is like modern music these days. And I'm talking like rock, I'm talking like everything, like, you know, electronic pop, like EDM, like hip hop and rap. You won't really get this unless you have a really good understanding of like music from back in the 60s, back in the day, or any time in the 20th century, like from the 70s to the 80s, you know, I mean, you're not going to really understand this unless you have a good understanding of music from back then. And what I'm talking about is this. In the 60s, it wasn't all about lead guitar, actually. It wasn't all about like Jimi Hendrix or like shredding and everything. In the rock circles, yes, it was a lot about guitar, but in the sort of pop rock R&B soul world, it wasn't just all about lead guitar. There was also somebody who played a horn/woodwind instrument called saxophone. It's basically a horn instrument with woodwind characteristics. But yeah, it's there were musicians out there who played saxophone, and there were songs that had solos played by the saxophone, and these saxophone solos were just as nasty and filled with tons of notes and tons of just like awesomeness as much as guitar solos were. I mean, the saxophone solos in a lot of these records were like, I mean, like, who needed a guitar when you can just have, you know, saxophone play the solo? And there's a lot of records where there was a huge emphasis on the lead tenor sax, and there was a lot of songs that have like tenor sax solos in them, and depending on the record, you know, if it was like a vocal group record, then the saxophone solo wouldn't be that crazy for the most part. Or if it was like a pop record with a male solo lead singer or female solo lead singer. The solos wouldn't be that crazy, but for records recorded by this group in particular, Junior Rock and the All-Stars, there was the saxophone solo was just crazy. Every single record was all about the lead tenor sax. And that's because the guy who was Junior Rock of Junior Rock and the All-Stars, he was a singer, but not that good of a singer. I mean, yeah, he could sing. He can hit notes. He could sing on key because you had to do that back in the 60s. Otherwise, you weren't having any success. You had to be a good singer back then. So he could hit notes and sing on key because there was no autotune back then. But that wasn't his main focus. His main focus was essentially playing tenor lead sax. That was his bag, right? And he was originally, like a lot of Motown artists, he was around Detroit back in the 60s. And he was brought to label by two guys who actually produced last week's song, What Does It Take to Win Your Love for Me? And he was around Battle Creek, Michigan before he got signed to Motown. He was in the Army at the time, and he had a band called the Jumping Jacks, and the drummer of the band, Billy Nix, was a friend of his, and he was in a group called the Rhythm Rockers, and basically Junior Walker would eventually join the Rhythm Rockers, and they actually changed their name to the All Stars. And that's how the group became Junior Rock and the All-Stars. And they were originally stationed out of South Bend, Indiana, where they got a gig on a TV show in South Bend, Indiana. But eventually they moved to Battle Creek, Michigan. And they changed their name to Junior Rock and the All-Stars. And it's so funny looking at who Junior Walker is and his sound. A lot of his influences predate the 50s and basically in the beginning of rock and roll. I mean, like Louis Jordan, who was someone who was a saxophone player who did race music, like rhythm and blues, that whole thing. You know, that the thing that the black artist created. He was an influence for Junior Walker, and he came way before the whole Motown thing happened. So he was definitely an influence. And what happened was that before they got signed to Motown, they were discovered by Johnny Bristol, and then Johnny Bristol brought them to Harvey Fuqua, and Harvey Fuqua signed to one of his labels. But then at the time, Harvey Fuqua. So here's the thing. So this, a lot of people may not know this, but Harvey Fuqua was a songwriter that had deep connections to Berry Gordy, because his wife Gwen Fuqua wrote with Berry Gordy. He tied with Tyrone Carter, Rockabilly Davis. They wrote all those hits for Jackie Wilson, right? And Berry Gordy took a lot of that money and then created the Motown Record Company, right? So Harvey Fuqua Harvey Fuqua was in the Moonglows, and the Moonglows had Marvin Gaye before he was Marvin Gaye. So there you go. So there's a connection with Motown right there. Harvey Fuqua knew Marvin Gaye from the Moonglows and brought him to the attention of Berry Gordy, and Berry Gordy signed him as a session drummer and then later on as a singer. So Harvey Fuqua, was someone who's affiliated with Berry Gordy because his wife Gwen Fuqua wrote with Berry Gordy, and he was the one. He had his own record companies. In fact, one of the record companies he had actually was the first to release Someday We'll Be Together, which later became a huge hit for the Supremes at the very end of their career. It was their last number one hit as Diana Ross and the Supremes. Even when the Supremes, there were no singers, the Supreme singers on that, it was just the background singers, the Andantes, and there was no Supremes on that record except for Diana Ross. They were the first to release that in 1961. So, it was released on one of those record companies that Harvey Fuqua had. And yeah, so Harvey Fuqua owned the label that the Junior Walk and the All-Stars were signed to. and they were and Berry Gordy bought out that record company. And Berry Gordy actually bought a lot of record companies that are based in Detroit. I mean, he can Detroit was like the apple of the recording industry Motown was like the apple of the recording industry in Detroit, Michigan at that point. I mean, they really, Berry Gordy owned and controlled every single aspect of the Detroit music business at that point. And he bought out the record company that the Junior Rock and the All-Stars were on, and they got therefore became Motown artists. The same thing happened with Edwin Starr, because Edwin Starr was on the Riktik label, which was a label owned by Eddie Wingate, and it was Golden World and Riktik, and it was his labels, but then he sold his portion of the record company to Berry Gordy. Berry Gordy took over Golden World Studio B, and therefore that became Hitsville Studio B while he still had Hitsville Studio A. So yeah, so Junior Walker became an artist for the label. And now here's the thing. So this is also the other interesting thing about Junior Walker and the All-Stars, and this is kind of what set them apart from other Motown artists. Junior Walker and the All-Stars are banned, and this is kind of trippy because every single group signed to Motown was a vocal group. Nobody, I'm pretty sure nobody was a band signed to Motown at that point. Everybody was a vocal group. Everybody just sang. Nobody played their own instruments on their recordings. Everyone just sang, and then Berry Gordy had the Funk Brothers play on the records. They would have like Harvey Fuqua or Johnny Bristol or Mickey Stevenson or Clarence Paul or one of the producers from Motown, Smokey Robinson, Hollandish Holland, Norman Whitfield, they all used the same musicians, the Funk Brothers. James Jamerson on bass, Eddie Willis, Joe Messina, Robert Wyatt on guitar, Johnny Griffin, Earl Van Dyke, and Joe Hunter on keyboards. Richard Pistol Allen, Uriel Jones, and Benny Benjamin on drums. Jack Ashford on percussion. He all used the same musicians on the records. I mean, Motown pretty much had the same backing musicians. James Jamerson on bass. Everyone played. It was all the same people basically playing on all the records, right? And then you had Andrew Mike Terry doing the baritone saxophone solos, and then Kazuka Mafia sometimes doing the saxophone solos, and Wilbur Moore doing the tenor saxophone solos. Those guys typically did the tenor saxophone solos. I mean, you know, so Motown pretty much used the same musicians on everything, right? And then there were some people came in there like Melvin Wild Watson, Dennis Coffey on guitar, Bob Babbitt on bass, and basically everyone Motown used the same players and everything, but they kind of took a risk by signing Junior Walker and the All-Stars because they're like, hey, these guys are a band. These guys can play their own instruments on their recordings. Like, why are we using these people? And, you know, a lot of the musicians in Junior Walker and the All-Stars include Willie Woods, Victor Thomas, and other people in the group. So they're probably thinking, okay, why are we signing this band when we could just have Junior Walker as a solo artist, and then we can basically, have everyone else, use the Funk Brothers as musicians. Well, to be honest with you, what they actually wound up doing is that they wound up using a mix of the All-Stars, the band and the group that toured and did all the shows and did all those things with Junior Walker live. They wound up using a mix of that band plus the James Graves was the drummer too on that band too. So it was Victor Thomas, Willie Woods. What they did is that they used a mix of the band Junior Walker and the All-Stars plus the Funk Brothers, the guys that they used on every single record they did. Didn't matter if it was the Marvelettes or the Velvets or, you know, the Supremes, the Four Tops, the Temptations, Stevie Wonder, Marvin Gaye. They always use the same musicians every single session. And on the Junior Walker and the All-Stars sessions, they wound up using a mix of the band plus the Funk Brothers, which is pretty cool because then you kind of know that, okay, you know, the Junior Walker and the All-Stars, the guys that played the records live, you know, on either on TV or in person, they're the same guys who play on the records too. They're playing along with the Fun Brothers. So that's really cool. And as far as the musicians, it doesn't take to win your love for me. We know that the Undantes are the background vocalists. That's 100% true. The Undantes are the background vocalists on their record. They are the female background vocal group that sang on every single Motown record. I mean, they helped out the Four Tops in so many records. And even like the Isley Brothers and, you know, Marvin Gaye. I mean, the Undantes are pretty much everything. The Originals were the male background vocal group, and they became hit artists for Motown eventually too, a lot later. But they sang on all the records. The Undantes and the Originals basically were like the background vocal group on every single Motown record. So we know that for a fact. The Undantes are in fact the female background vocal group on the song. The other thing is that the as far as the musicians are concerned, it's not super well known as to who's playing on the session, but I can guarantee you, since Harvey Fook and Johnny Bristol produced a session with her, they wrote the song with Vernon Bullock, they used whoever's playing on Your Precious Love and Marvin Gaye and Tammy Terrell. It's the same people. In fact, that whole thing where I was talking about in part one, where I was explaining that there was the guitars on playing on top of the bass. On that record, Your Precious Love, that was Joe Messina on guitar and James Emerson on bass. They're doing the exact same thing on What Does It Take to Win Your Love For Me. It's the same musicians probably playing this very similar part. But yeah, so that I know that's probably true. Jack, you know, again, it's Jack Asher in percussion. You know, either Benny Benjamin, Earl Jones, or Richard Pista Allen. I mean, it's easy to kind of figure out who the musicians were, even if you don't know exactly who they were. But I will say this: it's 1969, so I highly doubt they did the whole thing live. I think they more than likely overdubbed it. They probably cut the basic track first, right? They cut the rhythm section first. And then everything else is overdubbed. I mean, they probably that tambourine part probably an overdub. The lead, the background singer is overdubbed. Strings overdubbed. Lead vocal overdubbed. Harmony overdubbed. Everything else is overdubbed. And they probably got the rhythm section live. Maybe it's possible, but I mean, you know, it's 1969, so they probably got the rhythm section live, and then they basically overdubbed everything else. Now I will say this. I'm going to go back a little bit further to what I talked about earlier on this podcast about how Motown would have this Friday morning quality control meetings every Friday morning just to see which songs get released and which ones wouldn't. There were some songs that, you know, that came up in the quality control meetings, and there were some songs that initially got some pushback, and they were like, wait a minute, like, do we want to release this or do we not want to? And this song was one of those songs that got some pushback, and they were almost not going to release it. They were like, we don't want to release this. And it kind of makes sense, because one thing you need to think about Junior Rock and the All-Stars, and this is something very important, I should probably say this, their sound, it did not really represent Motown. It was very gritty. It was dirty. It was like Southern soul. Like, if you listen to those records, it sounds really funky and almost like Wilson Pickett-esque, like very like Southern soul, like Memphis, Muscle Shoals. That's the kind of thing that Junior Walker was for Motown. It was their gateway into that kind of sound. And it was completely unlike the Supremes and the Four Tops and the Temptations and all these other groups. It wasn't really gritty or dirty or funky at all. And that's probably why it was a lot of this, their music was, all of it was released on the soul label. It wasn't even on the main Motown label. It was on a Berry Gordy subsidiary label, soul label, because it didn't sound white enough to get played on, you know, for it to be considered to the masses and white record buyers as well as black record buyers. So it doesn't surprise me that the song got some pushback, because they're probably thinking, oh, this doesn't sound like Junior Walk on the All-Stars. Because this, What Does It Take to Win Your Love For Me, was definitely a departure for them. I mean, it didn't sound like anything that they'd done in the mid-60s with Shotgun, I'm a Roadrunner, Shake and Finger Pop, the covers they did of How Sweet It Is to Be Loved By You and Come See About Me. This is a very different sounding song. It was smooth, and it was very, like, you know, not gritty or dirty at all. The saxophone solo was very smooth. So it doesn't surprise me that that's probably the reason why the song got rejected by the quality control meetings, because they probably thought, this sounds nothing like Junior Walk and the All-Stars' previous stuff. There's no way this is going to be a hit. And that's what happened. But then what happened was that they decided, you know what? Let's have the DJs play the song. And let's see if they let's listen to them first and see if we're right about this or not. So they did that. They handed the song to DJs, and the DJs played it, and they're like, wow. And then the record just took off, and people were requesting it, and people want to listen to it. And so they listened to the DJs, and they're like, okay, you're probably right. And there's a lot of records back in the 60s where the record company heads were very not really interested in releasing the song at first, but then the DJs thought the song was going to be a hit, and they played the songs on the air, and then the songs took off, and then the DJs had the last laugh, really. You know, or the record companies actually had the last laugh because they were wrong and the DJs were right. So, it's hard to get the sayings of, you know, it's, you know, I don't know what I'm saying, but I'm sure you get what I'm saying. Like, the record companies were wrong and the DJs were right. I mean, a good example of this is Groovin' by the Rascals, because Ahmet Erdogan didn't want to release the song, probably for the same reason. Motown didn't want to release this song, "Doesn't Take to Win Your Love for Me" by Junior Rock and the All-Stars. They didn't want to, Ahmet Erdogan didn't want to release Groovin' because it just sounded too much, didn't sound anything like, you know, the Rascals, the other songs. But then Murray the K listened to it, and then like, and he loved the song, and he said, this is going to be a huge hit. So they trusted him, and he played it on the air, and he was right. So that's how much power DJs had back in the 60s. I mean, they were very, very powerful people. I mean, they're just as powerful as the people that curate the Spotify playlists that are on Spotify, the user-generated playlists. They're that powerful. You know, they were that powerful back then. So, yeah, I mean, Junior Walker, I mean, he was definitely, like, his style of playing, you know, laid the groundwork for every sort of, you know, Quiet Storm, R&B kind of a soul sort of sound that happened later. I mean, you know, in fact, he actually played on a Foreigner song from 1981 from their album 4 called Urgent. So he did, you know, play on, you know, some records back then. And he actually toured with Junior Walker and the All-Stars in the 80s. But just that whole, like, saxophone sound. I mean, I'm not exactly sure what the name of this record is, but it's a George Michael song. But I'm sure you know it. It kind of goes... I mean, that record, I mean, I'm sure you know it if you're familiar with 80s music, but that's the sound of the saxophone on that record. Really, you know, he invented that sound in the 60s. It really did. Specifically, what "Does It Take to Win Your Love for Me?" He had that sound down back then. You know, I don't know exactly the name of the 80s song because I'm not the most knowledgeable person when it comes to 80s music, to be honest with you. Yeah, I mean, he basically invented that sound. I mean, the Classics 4 had a lot to do with that sound too. Because Stormy, Traces, Spooky, all those songs exemplified that saxophone sound that later became defined by the 80s Quiet Storm R&B. But, I mean, fasting forward to now, you know, you don't hear a whole lot of records today with saxophone solos like on "What Does It Take to Win Your Love for Me" by Junior Walker and the All-Stars. And that's kind of sad because I really like the sound of saxophone on records. I think it's the most beautiful sounding instrument of all time. I think more people should use it in their pop records. I actually have a friend who actually released a song with saxophone in it, but again, the saxophone on that song doesn't sound like this at all. It's very modernized. And again, it's sort of me having that sort of like 74-year-old mindset when it comes to music. I mean, you know, but that's just who I am. I love records that sound old. I mean, I'm not crazy about, like, records that sound modern. Even if I like the song, I'm still always going to love music that sounds old. I'm not going to like music that sounds brand new, like, you know, totally modern. I'm just, my Instagram handle is iHeartOldies, and it's because I love music that sounds old. And I don't care that we're, you know, way years and years and years past that sound already. And don't tell me to get with the times and stop living in the past, because I truly think that some of the best fucking music of all time, the music that will just never, that music that nobody will ever be able to top in the history of the the history of this entire world. I really do think that the best music of all time was recorded 50, 60 years ago. And, you know, I really, truly believe that. And I hope that you do too if you're a young person listening to this podcast. And that concludes this week's show. And just to clearly emphasize my point that Junior Walker was originally supposed to be a saxophone player, lead tenor saxophone player, not a lead singer. His first hit song, Shotgun, he originally wasn't supposed to sing lead on it. Motown was going to bring in a session singer to sing lead on the song, but the session singer couldn't make it to the session. So Junior Walker actually wound up singing lead on the song as well as playing lead tenor sax, creating this whole vibe of him being the lead singer and frontman of the group as well as the lead tenor sax player. But a lot of their songs were instrumental songs that, you know, that he didn't sing on at all. He just played tenor sax on. In fact, one of their not so well-known hits, Cleo's Mood, it's just him playing tenor saxophone, and it's all instrumental. There's no tenor, there's no singing on the song at all. So he was originally mainly focused on being a lead tenor sax player, not a singer, but he wound up playing on singing on Shotgun because the session singer didn't show up, so he became the lead singer and saxophone player for the group. And that's what made them kind of interesting, kind of unique, because there weren't any other groups out there like that where he had the lead singer being a lead tenor sax player. I mean, King Curtis wasn't a singer. He was just a tenor sax player, but Junior Walker could sing as well as play lead tenor sax. So that's what made him so different. And they also really represented this the slight sort of venture that Motown was going to go into just for a little bit, where they were briefly straying away from their formulaic Motown, you know, pop soul sound that appealed to more white audiences and slightly into the more blacker side of R&B soul, reminiscent of Wilson Pickett, Otis Redding, Percy Sledge, and, you know, just that whole sort of funky James Brown, very like R&B soul, not so whitewashed, black R&B pop soul, not necessarily that Junior Walker and the All-Stars represented Motown's brief tipping their toe into that sort of style and genre, but it wasn't necessarily what they're well known for, to be honest with you. They're well known for more white sounding black R&B pop soul, but not really the more blacker sounding music that was more popular in the R&B charts than it was in the pop charts. But that was their slight foray into that genre. But then they quickly went back into the more white sounding R&B pop soul, like, you know, what they were most well known for, like the Supremes, Four Tops, Temptations, Smokey Robinson, The Miracles. All that stuff was very white sounding, and like Marvin Gaye too. But anyways, so that concludes part two of episode number 205, Homemade 60 Music Podcast, The Millennial Throwback Machine. I'm Sam Williams, and if you found out some really cool and interesting behind the scenes facts from this week's episode, this song, What Does It Say to When You're Love For Me, and you found a lot of good information about Junior Walker and the All-Stars, and you didn't really know anything about them before, and you didn't grow up listening to their music, and maybe your parents did, but maybe you didn't, you know, and you're learning about this music for the first time through me, and you're a millennial Gen Z, please email me at samltwilliamicloud.com. You can also follow me and reach out to me on Instagram and TikTok at iHeartOldies, and you can also, definitely follow me on there, but also check out some of my music too. My latest single, Don't Look the Same Anymore, the link to that is in the description of this episode of this podcast. And another thing you can check out, the link in the description of this episode of this podcast, is the pre-inscription version of this podcast, where all my future interview episodes are going to be on. Definitely check that out, because I got another one coming out this month with Tony Powers, songwriter from the Brill Building in New York City. He wrote hits like Today I Met the Boy I'm Going to Marry, Why Do Lovers Break Each Other's Hearts, all by Darling Love, and also 98.6 by Keith and Ain't Gonna Lie by Keith, and Lazy Day by Spanky and Our Gang, and Remember Then by the Earls. He wrote all those hits. And my interview episode with him will come out this month. And please stream my song, Don't Look the Same Anymore, too. It's a really great song. I love the kick-ass energy in it. And it should be a really good motivator for you if you want to stay healthy and you want to stay fit and also lose some weight, too. You know, get in shape, you know. I mean, I really hope that you like the song, and I really hope it motivates you to do that. But yeah, so link to that in the description of this episode of this podcast. And also, you can check out the two interviews I did last year with Honk Magazine. Shout out LA. I'm in the process of scheduling my next interview. I think it's going to be a radio interview, like an audio interview, 97.3 The Rock. That's who I'm probably going to do it with. I'll let you guys know when I do that, when that's out, and I'll post a link to that somewhere. You'll probably find it on my social media page, more than likely in my link tree. That's probably where I'll be at once it's out. But yeah, but in the meantime, you can check out the two interviews I did with Honk Magazine, shout out LA. There's a link to those in the description of this podcast. And yeah, also check out the official Spotify and YouTube playlist for this podcast. They'll be able to find all the songs I've talked about on my show so far, including this one, "The Protest Takes Him and Your Love for Me" by Junior Bach and the All-Stars. Check this out and definitely send me suggestions for songs to talk about next time on podcast that I haven't yet. And if you have any of those suggestions for me, please email me at samltwoolley@icloud.com. You can also follow me, reach out to me on Instagram and TikTok at iHeartOldies. And yeah, also you can check out the official Red Bull merch store for this podcast. I really need to buy something from that store because I haven't really been pushing it on social media lately because I haven't had anything from that merch store in a very long time, but I will be getting something from it soon. I just can't buy anything right now because I really don't have any money to spend at this moment in time, but I will have some money coming in soon, so I will be able to buy something from the merch store. But yeah, so, and that's why I need your guys' help. Please sign up for the premium subscription versions podcast, because you know, it would really help me out financially, and you get to hear all these cool interviews. But I mean, really, the hope for me with those interviews is that they get heard by a much wider audience, by a lot more people. I would love these interviews to be used in rock history classes in different colleges and universities, and have professors use my interviews, because that would be really cool, because then a bunch more people, and that my kind of people that I'd want to hear these interviews, the younger people who are going to be around for much longer than the baby boomers, the millennials and Gen Zs, they'll get to hear my interviews and learn from me and also my guests. I think that'd be really cool. But yeah, so hopefully that happens. I think that may be a possibility. We'll see. But yeah, so also my next song comes out March 15th, but I'll talk to you guys more about that a little bit later when it gets a little closer to the release date. But for now, please stream my song "Don't Look the Same Anymore." It's out now on all the streaming platforms, and it's under my Instagram, my artist name, Sam L. Williams. But yeah, so I'm Sam Williams, and thank you guys for joining me for this week's episode of my podcast, The Millennial Throwback Machine. Until next week, please keep it.